right. Well, today we're in the third week of our series called Stories of Grace. And we've been talking a lot about what God's grace means in our life when it intersects our life. But we've been looking at some stories in the Bible that illustrate what God's grace is like. And a lot of what we've talked about is what God is all about. It's not what we can do for God and climbing the ladder to get to Him, but what God has done for us. And that's what grace is all about. And I'm so glad to welcome back my good friend and former campus pastor, Michael McCord, who's bringing the message today. We're team teaching this series. I'll be closing it out next week. But Michael is an incredible, not only follower of Jesus, but an awesome preacher. And I learned so much from him in his ministry. I got to kind of serve alongside of him. I was kind of like we didn't call it president. We was kind of the ministry team leader of the Wesley Foundation in Macon. And Michael was our campus pastor and learned so much about ministry from him. And I'm so glad to be able to welcome him again back to the Fountain. But I want to tell a quick story about him. Well, first of all, let me tell you what he does now. He's not at Mercer. He's actually in charge of overseeing all the campus ministries for the Wesley Foundations in the whole state of Georgia. So if you know somebody who's about to go to college, if you know somebody who's already out there, if you have any questions about the Wesley Foundations, Michael will be happy, I'm sure, to answer questions and to share a lot more. They're doing great, great work. And I think that he said they have like 4,000, a little bit over 4,000 students throughout the state of Georgia that are part of ministries. And some of our students are as well. So pretty cool. A really quick story about Michael. And this is, you know, with grace, there's also some opportunity to get a little jab sometime, you know. So I want to let you know, Michael is not just a great pastor, but he's a comedian as well. And we were I'm not going to tell you the date. It was when I was in college, and we went on this mission trip to Lake Wales, Florida. And we were doing mission work there. We were working on a roof, and we were singing really loud on top of the roof. And I'm sure the neighbors hated it. But a hurricane had come through and had just completely wrecked the area. So we were there being the hands and feet of Jesus and doing that. So anyway, took a little break to go toward the beach. And we're driving that way. And we noticed one of the guys in the back that was on the mission trip with us had fallen asleep conveniently on the way there. And we were in the church van. And so Michael decided, let's play a little trick on this guy. And so he told us on the count of three, here's what we're going to do. And he told us, I want you to scream as loud as you possibly can. And so we're on this road. Nobody's out. Nobody else is on the road. So we're driving down the road. And so he says, 1, 2, 3. And he hits the brakes. And everybody screams really loud, and the guy jumped up, hit his head on the roof, and it was so funny. So we can have a lot of fun in the church, but I want you to know a great guy coming up. So let's help welcome Michael McCord.
Thank you, Andy. I think the moral of that story is don't fall asleep while I'm in charge of things, whether that's preaching or driving, either one of those. That was a fun experience. If any of you have ever done roofing in July in the middle of Florida, it's quite an experience. You get a little, you know, dehydrated and lose your train of thought. But man, it's great to be here. I'll be back with you all to share in this experience with Andy to see what he's built here. And I'm going to point out another ministry team leader, former ministry team, Sarah, in the back, and our worship leader, Josh Cook. They got married. They've had their first baby, and they're about to be church planters in Denver, Colorado. So they're home with Sarah's family for a little bit before they head out there. So I encourage you to say hello to them on the way out and pray for them and their new ministry that they're going to start. You know what it's like as a congregation, as a new congregation, to start something new and something different, and they're about to do that. So the thing I'll say about that is your offering, in just a little bit after communion, you're going to take up an offering. And a portion of your offering goes to what's called apportionments, and that's money that goes to the conference that supports ministries like ours. So it supports my salary, the work I do, supports all of our Wesley Foundations, the 28 campuses that we support in the state of Georgia. And that enables us to support people like Josh and Sarah and Andy and so many others who grew up in those ministries and they go out and change the world through the ministries that they serve. So I just want you to think about that when you give your offering. It's not just supporting this church. It is doing that. But it's supporting ministries across the state of Georgia, which is pretty, actually it's across the whole world. 1,400 locations around the world that your ministry helps to support. So pretty amazing stuff. So I want to share with you this morning a story of grace that I think is one of the most interesting stories we have. It's the most interesting moment that I think you encounter with a disciple in particular. And it's a story of radical grace that I hope and I think is meaningful for all of us. And if you could think about this one phrase as we go through it, that your past doesn't dictate your future. Don't allow your past to dictate your future. So here's the story. It comes from John. John is a fantastic book to read. It's like watching a movie, you know. John's an incredible author that pays attention to the story and is very much focused on theology and trying to express this idea of grace to all people. And so at the end of John, John 21, is after the crucifixion has happened, after the resurrection has happened, and it's the end of sort of the journey. It's sort of these farewell images of Jesus appearing to the disciples. There's a passage right at the end of 20. It says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name." That's the crux of the John story, and told in such a beautiful way. So this is right at the end to try to help us believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and through Jesus we get life. All right, so the story happens that all that's happened, Jesus' resurrection, and the disciples have gathered together around the Sea of Galilee. And what we can gather from this is that they're rather despondent. Their rabbi is gone, the leader who's moved them around. I mean, they've been part of incredible things, right? I mean, they've seen thousands of people be fed out of just a couple loaves of fish and bread. And then you've also seen miracles of people being healed, resurrected. I mean, these incredible moments. They've also witnessed their leader be crucified. But they've also witnessed the resurrection. And yet here they find themselves completely sort of despondent. And what do? They go back to what they've known. They're gathered around the Sea of Galilee. And it says this: "Simon Peter said to the disciples, 'I'm going fishing. I don't know what else to do.' They said to him, 'We'll go with you.' They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing." So here they've gone back to what they knew before, and they can't even get that right. They've caught nothing. And so Jesus then, just after daybreak, Jesus stands on the beach, but the disciples don't know that it's Jesus. And he says to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" Now, just because a couple weeks ago I preached on the woman at the well. Very interesting sort of allusion here. This is where John gets really sort of beautiful with the way he tells a story. As the story progresses, it flashes back to scenes we've seen before. And here's one where we encounter the woman at the well, and Jesus comes up and he approaches her and he says, "Woman, do you have anything to drink?" And now we see Jesus approaching the body of water, and the disciples are out on the boat. "Do you have any fish?" "No," he said to them. "Cast the net to the right side of the boat and you'll find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. The disciple whom Jesus loved, John, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard this, here's the most interesting piece of the story of the disciple. Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on some clothes because he was naked. Did anybody hear fish naked? I'm just curious. Anybody? You don't have to. Yeah, don't raise your hand. We don't need to. So he's fishing naked in the boat, and he jumped into the lake. He put some clothes on and jumped to the lake. But the other disciples came to the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from land, only about 100 yards off. When they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire. Please remember that. Another allusion. Charcoal fire there, with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have caught." So that Simon Peter went aboard, hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Interesting story, isn't it? Matthew tells a story very similar to it at the call of the disciples, where there's not enough. Simon Peter again is out there, he can't fish, and Jesus tells this story, and they drag in fish. But now here we are at the end of it. Sort of a reminder of that original call story. We have Peter, who's lost again. Even though he's been through all of that experience with Jesus, has found himself in a place where he is stuck and gone back to what he's comfortable with, and yet he can't even do that. And then we find him in this most peculiar situation where he's naked fishing, and when he realizes it's the Lord, he throws his coat on and then jumps in the water. Not the normal thing you would do. Like, if you're naked in the water, I would think I would just go ahead and jump in the water and not put the coat on. But in this case, he puts his outer coat on and jumps in the water. I want you to pause and think about it. This is a piece that's sort of come to me in this study this week. Is go back to Genesis chapter 3. Adam and Eve, the creation has happened. Adam and Eve are in the garden. They've been told to not eat the tree in the middle, tree of knowledge, good and evil, the apple. But, you know, we have all kinds of images. So we're told not to eat of this fruit, right? But they do it anyway. And then what happens right after that? They're trying to hide. And when God comes among them, they recognize they're naked and they begin to try to close themselves. Before they sinned, they were naked and unashamed. But then when they realize their brokenness, they try to cover themselves up. So here we find Peter, another instrumental character in the story of God's work in the world. And he himself recognizes his own failures, his own mistakes, his own sinfulness, his own brokenness. And when he approaches the Lord and the Lord approaches him, he drops and he tries to cover up and he realizes he's naked and he jumps in the water and tries to hide and go ashore. Why? What kind of event happened in Peter's life? So this is part of the beautiful part of John, is these sort of back and forth allusions between what's happened and what's going to happen and how God continues to redeem our story, even though we mess up. Well, if you go back to John 18, there's this image of Peter outside of the trials of Jesus. So Jesus has been captured. He's taken to trial. This is a beautiful story because the way the sort of the scene happens, John tells this. There's a flash of the court scene, and then you go outside where Peter is standing warming his hands by a charcoal fire. And then it goes back to the trial, and then it goes back to Peter. And what happens in these three moments is that Jesus is being convicted, and then at this first moment where he's warming his hands by the charcoal fire, a woman approaches him, recognizes him. And he says, "Oh, you're that disciple, right? You're the one with the one who's on trial, right?" Anybody know what Peter says? No, that's not me. You got the wrong guy. I don't even know who he is. I'm just trying to keep warm by this fire." Then a flash of the scene again of the court case, and then back out, and Peter's at another place, and another person recognizes him, and yet again, he denies knowing Jesus. And then another part of the conviction series, and then it goes back, and again, Peter denies Jesus. So what we have is this amazing character who's experienced incredible moments along the way with Jesus, even walked on water, right? And at the end of that, when Jesus needs him the most, he's MIA. He's standing out warming himself by a fire, and he denies Jesus. And Jesus is killed, Jesus resurrected. And even though the resurrection is experienced, and Simon Peter is right there and sees him, when he's gone again, he finds himself despondent and back wondering what to do with his life. And what does he do? Scoop up his net, the way of his old living, and can't manage to do that either. So we find him humiliated and broken and naked. But the story doesn't end there. The story continues. Jesus invites them to breakfast. And what do we have for breakfast? We have a charcoal fire cooking fish and bread. Do you remember the stories of the fish and bread that fed thousands? And then the story of the upper room where they're eating together right before Jesus is caught, the final supper, the last supper, having bread and juice, the Passover feast together. Once again, Jesus calls the disciples, as messed up and as imperfect as they are, pulls them yet back together again and offers this food, this meal of forgiveness, and reminds them whose they are. And in particular, he knows Peter's brokenness and suffering that he has in the midst of his life now. And he has this interchange with Peter. So when they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time, he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time. Do we see the allusion? A third time, "Do you love me?" He said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Jesus knew the brokenness that Peter was carrying with him, this particular scene of denial, and offers an opportunity of atonement. Atonement literally means being brought back into tune, brought back into tune with God, and offers these three moments of atonement, of grace, to echo the three moments of denial. What that says for us is that God is in tune with our brokenness. But what it also says is that we are not to let our past decisions, our past mistakes, our past brokenness dictate our future. And even more importantly, that maybe is that we don't allow it to destroy our present. And what we see here is a man who's allowed his past mistakes to destroy his present scenario. But what we then also see is a creator who sits with us in the midst of our brokenness and writes for us a new future. We see Peter go on and build a church. What I wonder is how many of us are allowing our past to destroy our current reality. And how many of us in our past are moments of bad decisions, brokenheartedness, hurt, pain, suffering that keeps us from believing that God can use us in any form or fashion in the future. That what has happened has destroyed what could be. Today's story of grace is a reminder that no matter what has happened in us, God can reclaim that and use it for something that is good. For Peter doesn't lose what has happened, but what has happened creates him into a leader who can build a church, who can endure suffering, who can lead others. I wonder how many of us allow what we've done to affect us today. There's a story that happened when I was in seminary and doing the Wesley Foundation. And I worked in Macon at Mercer and then went to school at Candler at Emory for seminary. And it was about a 2-hour drive back and forth. I went 2 days a week. It was the most grueling, 3 years of my life, but also the most rewarding 3 years of my life. But this particular day, I had to get up. Class was at 8:00 in the morning in Atlanta. So that meant we had to leave about 5:30 to get there. So we'd get up about 4:30, 4:45. I'd meet some friends. We'd drive together those 2 hours and get there just in time for class. And this particular day at 8:00, I had an Old Testament test. I am not a biblical scholar. An Old Testament is something that the United Methodist Church in all of my history and my upbringing just don't spend a whole lot of time with. An Old Testament, when you're testing Leviticus, it's just a rough day. And then I had not only did I have the Old Testament test that morning, but I had a 15-page church history test in the afternoon. And so I'm just already feeling on the edge, you know, I'm not prepared for any of this. And I take the test, and you know what it's like to take a test. You just feel like, even if you don't fail it, you just feel like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. And then I go right into that to finish the paper. I don't finish it till right at the time it's supposed to be turned in. And it's one of those, I'm just completely and utterly despondent about myself. I think I don't have the skills. I am not smart enough. I'm not gifted enough. I'm not gracious enough to be a pastor. I don't even know why I'm in seminary. And here I got to get in the car and drive another 2 hours in Atlanta rush hour traffic to get back. Class ends at 6:00. I get back right at 8:00. And yet, you know what I haven't done yet? I haven't even thought about a sermon. Not even thought. And so I'm on the verge of tears driving back thinking this, how can I teach a college student anything when I'm this broken? I can't do this. And so I pull up to the house right at about 8:00 and I see the students and they're so happy and so full of energy and ready for worship, you know, and I'm thinking, I cannot go in there. I can't. I don't have anything left. I'm not able to do this. But I suck it up and I get out and I walk up, and as I'm walking up, we're in an urban location, kind of downtown Macon, and we have a lot of homeless people who would join us for worship sometimes, or we give them food or invite them to come to food afterwards. And we got to know a lot of them, but it usually entailed a lot of work. And as I get out, I see a man walking towards us who by all appearances is homeless. And I just think, oh, I really can't deal with that too. So there I am, standing on the front porch of the Wesley House, all the students around, worship is about to get ready, and this man walks up, and I'm just thinking, I have nothing left for anybody, and I am not able to do anything. And he walks up to me, and as he approached me, he sticks his hand out, and he shakes me, and right on the tip of my tongue, I'm thinking, I don't have any cash, but I'm glad to give you a food. Come join us for worship. That was kind of the phrase that I would use. And as he reaches out his hand, he hands me a $20 bill. And he looks me in the eye and he says, I can't believe what you guys do here with college students, and I want to be part of it. I hope this helps to care for them. And turns around. I mean, this man, if he's not homeless, he is on the verge of homelessness. And he hands me $20 because he believes in helping these students. And he turns and with a twist and is whistling as he walks off. And I'm standing there, you know, I mean, now I'm like, oh, geez, like this guy, he's for real. I am such a fake, you know. I've got nothing. I'm ready at this point to quit my job and go back to my old job selling women's shoes at Dillard's. That was how bad it was at this moment, you know. I'm done. And he turns around and he walks up and he gets like right up in my face, you know, like you can feel his breath and his spit on you when he's talking to you. That close, please don't do this. It's too much in my personal face. And he's right up in there. And you know what he says? He says to me, you're standing too close to the mirror. I wonder how many of us find themselves every morning standing in front of that mirror and seeing everything that's wrong. Because you know when you get up close, you know what you see? You see the pores, you see the blackheads, you see the chicken pox scars, the scars from whatever trouble you and your brothers got into. You see everything about you that's just not right. And you get so close that all you can see in that mirror is yourself and your own brokenness. You can't see the people around you. You can't see the family that loves you. You can't see your friends or the people that you've influenced along the way. All you see when you wake up in the morning and stare at yourself is what you haven't done or what you've done that you wish you hadn't done. And we allow our past to destroy our present. And when it does that, we can't even see a future. I think what this story shares for us today and what we have an opportunity to do today is to step away from the mirror, to realize that our past doesn't dictate our future and that we've got a God who sits with us and knows our sorrows and our hurts and will offer us grace specific to our needs, just as he offered grace specific to Peter's needs. So today, as you come and you receive communion, I want you to think about that pot of burning coal, charcoal, the fish being cooked, the bread prepared, and Jesus calling us back together. And then when you accept and receive this grace that you have today, what I want you to do, I'm going to challenge you that this week, every day, when you wake up, anybody here not look in the mirror on a given day? Well, that would be a challenge, wouldn't it? Get up and don't look in the mirror. That would be all. You should try that too. When you look in the mirror, I want you to speak words of grace, hope, and love into your life so that when you turn from that mirror and you step away, you can see the people around you who express that grace, hope, and love, but then you can also be a carrier of that grace, hope, and love in the world. Because that's what grace is about. It's about inhaling and exhaling God's love for us. So come and receive these gifts. Experience God's grace in your own life and enable yourself to share that with others so that your past doesn't destroy your future.
Amen. 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 What a great word. And as we come to the table this morning, we recognize that not only is this something that we can talk about, but we can experience grace at the table. And so we recognize that just before this story that Michael told us about with Peter and with all the disciples, really, that there was something Jesus did on the night in which he gave his life for us. He was sitting around the table with his friends, with his disciples, and he took bread and he gave thanks to God and he broke the bread and he gave it to the disciples and said, take and eat. This is my body, which is broken for you. do this in remembrance of me. And after the supper was over, the dinner continued, and he took the cup. And he gave thanks to God, and he gave it to his disciples and said, "Drink of this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." And so as we come to the table this morning, what an incredible reminder it is for us to taste and see that the Lord is good. That sometimes we're standing too close to the mirror, and sometimes we have to look in the mirror and be reminded, not of what we say, but of how the Holy Spirit, how our Father, how Jesus speaks over us. Not just amazing words of affirmation like, "You look good and you've done so many good things," but he speaks a word of grace. "I love you. I love you, and I've got a plan for your life." So as you come to the table this morning, as we prepare to receive of these elements, we know that that God is here in the middle of this place, and God wants to meet with you. Maybe even extending, it might be me or Michael offering you bread and juice, but I think it may just be the very heart of Jesus offering his grace to you today so that you can be filled and to go into the world to show people grace.